Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Nitzana Darshan Leitner, founder of the Shurat Hadin Israel Law Center that's recovered hundreds of millions of dollars from terrorist organizations to compensate terror victims, and the co-author of the book Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim, Hein Dinachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. As we begin a new secular year, I thought it might be interesting to explore just where American Judaism is right now at the end of the very first week of 2018. By the way, today also happens to be my birthday, which has very little to do with the overall state of Judaism in the United States, but perhaps a lot to do with my being in the mood for a little reflection. There has been a trend in the American Jewish world for quite a while now to talk about how we are in a post-denominational world, one in which Jews no longer consider themselves to be Orthodox, Conservative, or Reform Jews, or even Reconstructionist or Renewal Jews, but simply people living in a free society in which Jewish identity is a construct of their own making, in which every person gets to decide just what he or she wants his or her own Judaism to be. But the truth is that we have actually been doing this for an awfully long time in the U.S., deciding not only what branch or stream of Judaism we wish to participate in, but how often and in what ways we'll be active and whether we wish to participate at all in organized Jewish life. In the same way that American Jews have been intermarrying, that is, marrying non-Jews, in higher and higher proportions, we've also been doing what we personally wish to do about our own Jewish involvement and practice in every aspect of our lives. Or we have been simply choosing not to regularly do Jewish acts like praying or doing holiday or Shabbat rituals or Jewish study or, well, not doing anything Jewish at all. Since the American Jewish community might well be the most self-obsessed subset of the entire national population, the president excepted, we have conducted many studies of ourselves. In nearly all the most recent ones, the largest subset of American Jews say that they are Reform Jews, perhaps as many as 40% of all American Jews. Last official study was 35%, so let's go with that. There are about 6 million American Jews, depending on whose definitions of Jew you accept and whose figures you rely on. If all of those people who say they are Reform Jews actually belonged to Reform synagogues, that would translate to a membership of 2 million Reform Jews. In fact, we know that the actual membership numbers for the Reform movement are fewer than 1 million affiliated people, meaning at least one out of every two Jews who say they are Reform don't actually belong to a Reform synagogue. The next largest denomination in America is a bit confusing because it's made up of those Jews who say they have no denomination at all, about 30% of all U.S. Jews. Since they don't have to join a temple or organization to prove they aren't part of a denomination, that should still be about 2 million Jews, in effect the largest subset that actually means something tangible. And it's worth noting that it's now entirely possible, even popular in some quarters, to simply hire Jewish clergy or teachers online to prepare for and hold life cycle ceremonies like bar and bat mitzvah, weddings, funerals. Synagogues in these circumstances become ancillary or even unnecessary institutions for the Jewish experience. The next largest segment of the American Jewish population is conservative Judaism, with 18% of the U.S. Jewish population, although again, a much smaller number actually affiliate with conservative congregations, a bit over half of that, about 600,000 Jews. 10% of American Jews are Orthodox. Unsurprisingly, most of them indeed do affiliate with Orthodox synagogues, although the numbers on Orthodox affiliations are less clear than in Reform and conservative movements for administrative and institutional reasons. In a change that's fairly recent, perhaps just in the last 10 or 20 years, about 60% of those people who identify themselves as Orthodox Jews in America say they are Haredim, ultra-Orthodox. That would include many of those who participated in Chabad congregations. Interestingly, the Orthodox Jews are younger and much more likely to be married than the non-Orthodox Jews, whether they are Reform, Conservative, non-denominational, Reconstructionist, or Renewal, or something else. Again, not surprisingly, Orthodox Jews have more children than non-Orthodox Jews, and their share of the U.S. Jewish population is therefore rising. And while only about 50% of Jews who are raised Orthodox stay that way, when you calculate the much higher marriage and birth rate, well, that does point to a trend towards orthodoxy in contemporary Judaism that is likely to continue to accelerate. In one way, the long-standing prediction that American Jews would become non-denominational has come true in part. Nearly a third of American Jews no longer connect Jewish identity with any movement or denomination, and movement affiliation has become far less strong among congregants who are there at most U.S. synagogues. But in another sense, that prophecy missed a crucial point, which is that the U.S. Jewish population continues to become, slowly but steadily, more Orthodox. The overall number of Jews in America is not growing. It may, in fact, be shrinking a little. But the Orthodox, and in particular the ultra-Orthodox proportion, is growing, both through natural growth, attracting newly observant Jews, and through the aging and gradual shrinking of the other movement's base demographic. Another interesting trend is that even for those who belong to congregations within the Reform and Conservative movements, there's more diversity than ever before existed in services, music, educational tastes, style. Being part of one congregation does not necessarily mean that another congregation in the same movement is particularly similar or might even be agreeable to you. It's not at all clear that American Judaism has truly become post-denominational, even after 30 or more years of elaborate scholarly discussion about the subject. But it would be accurate to say that Jewish experience in the United States has become pluralistic in nature, and that the trend towards individual choice has only accelerated. In other words, we're choosing more and more to choose what we want or don't want to bother with in our Judaism. It's unlikely that tendency is going to do anything but intensify in 2018 and every year thereafter. Play us in this morning. We have Amir Dadon's great song, Or Gadol, A Great Light, about learning what really matters in life.
יש סיבה לכל דבר לבד בתוך כל הטירוף אני חושב איך שהזמן יכול לעוף אבל בסוף כשזה נגמר יש סיבה לכל דבר אור גדול מאיר הכל ויותר כבר לא צריך לשאול אני בא ללמוד ממה שטוב ולחיות להתחיל הכל מההתחלה כמו לנשום בפעם הראשונה אני כאן אני לא מתבזבז יותר יכולתי רק לזכור לכל אחד יש את הדרך לעבור אבל בסוף כשזה נגמר יש תשובה לכל דבר אור גדול מאיר הכל ויותר כבר לא צריך לשאול אני בא ללמוד ממה שטוב ולחיות להתחיל הכל מההתחלה כמו לנשום בפעם הראשונה אני כאן אני לא מתבזבז יותר us
was Israeli singer Amir Dadon's song Or Gadol, A Great Light. Our guest this morning, Yitzana Darshan Leitner, an Israeli attorney who founded the Shurat Hadin Israel Law Center that has recovered hundreds of millions of dollars from terrorist organizations to compensate terror victims, at least financially. She's the co-author of the book Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. Hear her remarkable story when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish our guest this morning. Yitzana Darshan Leitner is an Israeli activist, a civil rights attorney, the president of Shurat Hadin, an Israeli law center based in Tel Aviv, which has worked to really change the landscape of the funding of terror by filing lawsuits on behalf of terror victims in a variety of important suits. She has a new book out called Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We tend to think about the battle against terrorism as the Mossad or other anti-terrorism groups. The Shin Bet, we don't think about it as a legal process, but of course that's in some ways been the most important work. Tell us a little bit about how you developed Shurat Hadin and how that became such an important weapon.
Look, we were living in Israel at the beginning of the Intifada in the year of 2000 when the blood was spilled on the streets of Jerusalem, of Tel Aviv. And we realized that as lawyers, we can take a role in the war against terrorism. Indeed, we are not part of the Mossad. We are not part of the military. We are not part of the government. We are the private sector. But the private sector also has a role in the fight and can protect and defend the state of Israel against those who want to devastate it. And as lawyers, we can do what lawyers do best. Go after the pocketbooks of the terror organization. We realize that money is the oxygen to the terrorism, and if we stop the flow of the money, we can stop the flow of the terrorism.
Tell us about the first successful case.
Well, in the beginning, we won, we brought lawsuits against the PA, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Iran, Syria, and it was quite unrealistic. How can you really go after this regimes? How can you go after these terror organizations? How will you find them? How will you serve them? How will you bring them to court? And even if you get a judgment against them, how will you collect them? But eventually, we were able to get jurisdiction to prove our cases, to get judgments against these terror regimes, and even to collect money. We are having cases going on against organizations like Hezbollah, PLO, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the Palestinian Authority, against countries supporting terrorism like Iran, Syria, North Korea, and banks that provide financial services to organizations like Arab Bank, National Wealth Center, Credit Lyonnais, UBS, Lebanese Canadian Bank, American Express Bank, Bank of China, and recently even took upon the social media network, suing Google, Facebook, Twitter for providing a platform to the organization. So far, we are able to win $2 billion in judgment. We're able to put a lien on $600 million in terror assets, and we were able to collect more than $300 million that went to the hands of the terror.
And that money went to help the victims of terror.
You know, no money can bring back life.
Of course.
But this money gives a measure of justice to the terror victims. They give them a measure of closure. They know that justice was done. They know that the one who devastated their life paid a very high price. And it sends a message that 70 years after the Holocaust, nobody can kill Jews and go without pay. The Jewish blood is not cheap. And Jews are fighting back.
We will talk much more with Nitzana Darshan Leitner. The new book is called Harpoon: Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. She's the president of Shurat HaDin and an extraordinary figure. We'll continue with her in a moment here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So there was a huge diplomatic brouhaha at the end of 2017 about the U.S. administration recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Lots of different opinions out there about that. I've testified to mine on the air that I think Jerusalem has been Israel's capital since at least 1950 and arguably since 1948, and we don't pretend any other country's capital isn't its capital. Let's hear your opinion, because there's obviously more involved than that.
Well, first of all, with all due respect, on the very last point you just made, we don't pretend that any other country's capital isn't its capital.
Really?
We frequently do, and I can give you several examples.
Oh, please.
The official capital of the Cote d'Ivoire, where I lived and worked, is Yamoussoukro, which was the home village of Houphouet Boigny, who led the country for 40 years and has the largest basilica in the world. He intentionally built it to be bigger than St. Peter's in Rome, and he set up a new capital with an international airport and all that, only nobody wanted to move their embassy to this little swamp-infested village. So all the embassies remain in Abidjan, which is the biggest city. It's sort of the Tel Aviv, if you will, of the Côte d'Ivoire, but it is not the capital. A similar case is Kazakhstan, where in the Soviet period, which was long and hard, there was a city called Alma-Ata, which means the father of all the apples in some Turkic language. And that was the capital in Soviet times. When it became independent from the former Soviet Union, the Kazakhstani leaders moved the capital to a city called Astana, much further north, centrally located. Geographically, it made sense in the same way that maybe that Brasilia makes sense. And significantly, from the Kazakhstani point of view, virtually no Russian population ethnically in Astana, whereas Alma-Ata, which changed its name to Almaty, still had a very large percentage of Russians. Well, very few embassies moved. A couple sort of slavish neighbors moved their embassies from Almaty to Astana, but virtually no one did, including the U.S. So there's at least those two cases, and probably more that don't spring to mind immediately because I haven't actually been there, where we don't locate our embassies in the capital of the country, and we de facto don't really recognize the same capital of the country as the government of the country does. So the case of Israel may be unique for Jews, and it may be uniquely important in terms of world peace, because it's unlikely that a war is going to break out over where the capital of the Côte d'Ivoire is. But I will say that your characterization of a brouhaha and major controversy is an unusual understatement on your point of view. It's a huge thing. And I was in St. Louis recently, and the rabbi of my parents' congregation gave a very political sermon about this, saying maybe the timing was wrong, but it's an announcement that should have been made long ago, and it's okay to discuss and disagree, but do so constructively and openly. So I, for reasons that I will explain in our next show, find the nature, the timing, and the whole set of circumstances surrounding this announcement to be further evidence that Donald Trump is unfit to be our commander-in-chief.
And on that uncontroversial note, Tom will pick this up next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Chendanachi and Tamir Shakuri. Boker Tov, you guys are going to be going to Israel soon. It's very exciting. What have you missed?
Well, first of all, Mazal Tov. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I don't know. I think that in Israel, I would be most excited to eat all of the foods I love. And although America has a great culinary experience to offer, it's different. And I miss my boyka son, Shuklevinsky. And I miss eating at like a Mediterranean, like, shipud house. I don't know how you say it.
And I'm not sure there's a way to say it.
Yeah. Like a skewer.
Yeah, a skewer place.
Skewer
That's right.
place. And I really like, I mean, I'm really looking forward to actually seeing the country like Tel Aviv. Like, I really miss that city from the bottom of my heart, just walking around. And of course, my friends, my family, my dog. Oh my gosh. My dog, Mitzi. Hmm. I miss her. So yeah, mostly burekas. I want burekas.
Food seems to be a very important part of your life. I don't know how to tell you this. Tamir,
what have
you missed being here? What are you looking forward to having in Israel?
So I really, really miss my friends. Of course I miss my family also, but my friends are like my second family because we grew up together and I see them every single day. And here, there are times where I speak to them more and times where I speak to them less, but when I have a week that I talk to them every day, I feel like I just want to like leave it all behind and just go and hang out with them because I really miss them. Also food, actually. Shawarma is something that I really, really miss. And schnitzels that my mom make. Although Melissa, my host mom here, also makes amazing schnitzels. Oh. But my mom's schnitzels are like the best in the world,
I
think.
Of course they have to be. They're your mom's.
Right. So I really, really miss that. And I miss like my extended family, my grandma, my uncles. I really look forward to seeing them again and see what has changed in the time that I was here. Just because I feel like everything is moving really fast when I'm here in Israel. But I think when I get to Israel, I'll see that everything kind of stayed the same and my friends are still my friends and my family is still my family.
I think what will have changed is you guys, because you've been through a lot of experiences that you never would have had. Even if you'd stayed in Israel and done the things that everybody's doing, gone in the army or done a Shnat Shirut there, a year of service there. May it be in the Siyat Tova, a wonderful trip.
And, thank you so much.
You'll come back with more stories for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A minister, a priest, and a rabbi go for a walk in the country near their town on a very hot day. They're sweating and exhausted when they come upon a small lake. Since it's secluded, they decide to take off their clothes and jump in the water naked. When they come out of the lake, they feel refreshed and invigorated, but as they emerge from the water, who should come along but a group of ladies from the town? Unable to get to their closing time, the minister and priest cover their privates, but the rabbi covers his face. The ladies see the naked clergyman and gasp in embarrassment and turn quickly and run away. As the sheepish religious men put their clothes back on, the minister and priest ask the rabbi why he covered his face instead of his privates. And the rabbi replies, "I don't know about you gentlemen, but in my congregation, it's my face they would recognize." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jewish Just for You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. As this week's portion of Vayera begins, the Israelites are in Egyptian slavery, and the mysterious figure of Moses has returned to try to free them from bondage. In Vayera, God brings about a series of plagues that traumatize the Egyptians and bedevil the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Blood, frogs, lice, wild beasts, boils, and cattle disease serially afflict the land and its inhabitants, or at least the non-Israelite inhabitants. In next week's portion of Bo, three more plagues come, hail, locusts, and darkness, all leading up to the final plague in the climactic death scene of the slaying of the firstborn, and of course the Exodus, the great moment in which our ancestors were freed from slavery. This is the model for narratives of deliverance and emancipation ever after. The plagues are interesting in and of themselves. There are three sets of three plagues each, increasing in severity and complexity. Every one designed to prove the power of the true God and the impotence of the pagan gods of Egypt. The Nile River was a principal deity of Egypt, as well as the source of its life and livelihood. And so, for the first plague, God simply turns it to undrinkable blood. There are frog gods in the Egyptian pantheon, and they are next turned into pests that infest homes and fields. The scarab is sacred beetle to Egyptians, a symbol of the pharaoh's power, and insects like it are next used to torment the inhabitants. So it goes. Sacred cows get diseases. The fertility of the Holy Land of Egypt itself is destroyed. Finally, even the great Ra, the highest Egyptian deity, the sun itself, is blotted out for days. The plagues are a statement of theology, of belief. There is only one God. And those who adhere to other gods and use their own power to enslave others will be overthrown by a greater power and with divine majesty. The arrogant will be overcome. Freedom will ultimately be guaranteed, and justice through the true God will triumph in the end. It is a message that still has resonance today. Whenever we come to believe that evil is destined to reign, that those who enslave others will rule, that the wicked who use control for malign purposes are destined to flourish, we should reread this plagues narrative in Exodus. For at heart, this is a universe created by God for good. God ultimately will return us to that path. No matter what malign actions are taken by those who are truly evil, God will ultimately bring about redemption. Our task is to work towards that end in our own ways. And so when we find ways that we can increase justice in this complex world, we are simply doing the work for which we were made, for which the universe was made, and thus serving God. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Nitzana Darshan Leitner, founder of Shurat HaDin Israel Law Center, will explain how they came up with a remarkable strategy that has been so effective against terrorist organizations, and about how working with the Mossad and its incredible pioneering leader made it possible to change the lives of terror victims. Hear from one of our most unusual guests when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Audrey Azoulay, the Director General of the UN's Culture and Education Organization, UNESCO, confirmed last week Israel has formally notified UNESCO of its withdrawal from the organization. Azoulay, UNESCO's first Jewish head, ironically, said she had been officially notified Israel will leave on December 31, 2018. I regret this deeply as it is my conviction that it is inside UNESCO and not outside of it that states can best seek to overcome differences in the organization's fields of competence, she said. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu instructed Carmel Shammah HaKohen, Israel's ambassador to UNESCO, to officially submit a letter of withdrawal from the organization. Israel's move comes several months after the U.S. State Department declared the U.S. will be leaving UNESCO by 2019 due to its anti-Israel bias, which it certainly has. While initially it looked as though Israel missed the deadline to withdraw in 2018, Shammah HaKohen did manage to submit the letter of withdrawal before the end of 2017. The October 12th announcement by the U.S. that it was pulling out of UNESCO followed two Arab-sponsored resolutions adopted this year that were incredibly critical of Israel. One referred to the Jewish state as the occupying power in Jerusalem. Another declared the old city of Hebron as a Palestinian World Heritage Site. Last year, UNESCO passed resolutions declaring Israel has no right to Jerusalem and described the Temple Mount and old city of Jerusalem as Muslim holy sites. There is a long and painful history of UNESCO bias against Israel. Three rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip towards southern Israel last week, the Israeli army said. Israel's Iron Dome missile defense system intercepted two of the rockets. The third hit a building in the regional council of Shar HaNegev, causing damage. No casualties were reported. In response, the Israeli army struck two Hamas positions in the northern Gaza Strip by tank and aircraft fire. Earlier, rocket sirens sounded in the regional councils of Shar HaNegev and Sdot HaNegev. Sirens went off while a ceremony was being held at the nearby Israeli community of Kibbutz Kfar Aza in honor of the birthday of Oron Shaul, an Israeli soldier killed during the 2014 Gaza War. Hamas is supposed to be holding Shaul's body still. The leader of Israel's Labor Party, Avi Gabay, attended the ceremony. In other incidents last week, clashes erupted between Israeli security forces and Palestinian protesters in the West Bank cities of Ramallah, Hebron, Nablus, and Bethlehem. Some 2,000 protesters took part in 20 protests throughout the West Bank. Palestinian Arabs threw rocks and Molotov cocktails at Israeli security personnel, and riot dispersal means were employed by the Israeli forces. Approximately 2,000 more Palestinians took part in protests along the Gaza Strip. Four were shot when they tried to break through the border fence. 2 weeks ago, a rocket fired from Gaza exploded in the yard of a residential building in southern Israel's Chof Ashkelon Regional Council, another in a nearby open area. About 30 rockets have been fired from Gaza at Israel since U.S. President Donald Trump's December 6th announcement recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. This is the greatest number of rockets fired at Israel in any month since Israel's last war with Hamas in the summer of 2014. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted and honored to welcome back the Two Jewish, Nitzana Darshan Leitner. She's the founder of Shurat HaDin, the Israeli Law Center in Tel Aviv that has represented hundreds of terrorism victims in many successful lawsuits worldwide. The new book is called Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. It's an extraordinary story. Meir Dagan plays such a huge part in this. Tell us a little bit about his story and how you've worked so closely with some of these important organizations.
So Meir Dagan was the head of the Mossad in 2002 when buses were blown up on the streets in Israel, cafes, malls, people were getting killed on a daily basis. If you recall, there was the Park Hotel over Pesach,
right.
Killed, right? and the Delfinarium discotheque, 28 young people get killed.
Right.
Hebrew University cafeteria. All this terrorism was going on, and Mayor Dugan had a unit that he created, he established some years before, in the end of the 90s, which his goal was to go after terror funding. He realized that tens of millions of dollars are going into the hands of the PLO, of Hamas, of Islamic Jihad in the West Bank and Gaza, coming out from out of the country, from Iran, from Syria, from Saudi Arabia, and even from Islamic charities that raise funds in local Muslim communities in the United States and Europe, and funneling the money into the West Bank and Gaza. And he understood that there is a whole infrastructure of benevolent wing, of military wing, of this organization, that the only way to stop the terrorism and to hurt the terrorists is to choke their money off. So in 2002, he got these harpoon units, his agents, to start and doing operation against the terror leaders, against the terror organizations, against Yasser Arafat, against banks that wired money to the hands of the terror organizations, Jordanian bank, Egyptian banks. He decided that if after trying to speak to the banks and to ask them nicely not to wire money to terror organizations, and they refused to go and actually rob the banks. He bombed banks from the air. He initiated even con games against the Yasser Arafat, against the leaders of Hezbollah, just to separate away them from their money. And he was very successful. So we were, we had a front seat watching Mayor Dugan and the Harpoon unit agents in these operations in the course of Shura Dudin's work. They understood that the legal arm is one of the tools that will help in their financial warfare against terrorism. And they were providing us with information in order to go after specific targets that they weren't able to tackle.
You know, without getting too technical, financial matters are often really difficult to penetrate legally because of a variety of agreements to keep confidential, of how funding is arranged and where it's sent. It's a tricky thing. You've had some success. Where has it been most difficult to interdict the funding for terrorism?
Well, it's not for the layman to know. It's not for us to understand how this money is going into the hands of the terrorists. Obviously, it relies on intelligence information and on the inside sources, on techniques that the intelligence units are employing. And the Harpoon, in this instance, the Harpoon employed agents, spies, hackers to go and reveal this information and then to uncover him. And by going, you know, intercepting these wire transactions, employing agents in the banks themselves, secret agents, informers, to help them to achieve this information, getting into diplomatic relationship with other countries that assist them with this information. It's for governments, only intelligence agencies can recruit, extract this information. And then they were giving them to us.
How do you decide whether a case, to take a case or not?
It has a couple of considerations. First, we need to win the case.
It has to be a case you can win.
Yes, it has to be a case that we have enough evidence that will get us through motion to dismiss, get the court to be convinced that there is a case there. And it's important because we don't want to lose to this the rogue regimes. Second, we need to know what type of jurisdiction will be litigating the case. Where is the defendant located? If we want to bring a case against a bank, so we need to bring it in a place where he has branches or he runs businesses, he has other representations. And not every bank has branches in Israel, in the United States, in Canada, where we're litigating these cases. We have to find where the defendant is. We're not going to sue, bring lawsuits against the same defendant over and over again. If we have a lot of judgments against the Palestinian Authority or a lot of cases against the Palestinian Authority, we're not going to continue filing lawsuits against them. And in the end, we have to be, unfortunately, because we are a non-for-profit and because our resources are limited, it's all based on donations, and unfortunately we can't take all the cases, despite the fact that they are all worthwhile, we'll have to go with the cases that were most significant in their impact, in the impression they made in the survival they left after.
What do you feel has been your most important victory in court?
There were a couple. Perhaps the latest one is the judgment against the Palestinian Authority and the PLO for $655 million that we won in January 2015. In a case that was litigated in court for 11 years.
Oh my God.
When, yeah. Went to a jury trial despite all our efforts to settle the case with the PA and the PLO. But we had very strong evidence that the PA and the PLO supported the terrorists that committed the attacks. There were 10 families of terror victims as plaintiffs that lost their loved ones in the most heinous terror attacks in Israel during the first years of the Intifada. And they all were American citizens, and we were able to prove that the Palestinians and the PLO helped the terrorists, supported them, and provided them with weapon, money, ammunition, safe haven, and they had the superior liability over them as their employers. Must point out that all these attacks were done by employees of the Palestinian Authority, like Palestinian policemen, Palestinian security guards, and we indeed won this judgment. Today, unfortunately, the judgment was reversed. It's on appeal. It reached all the way to the Supreme Court. And it will take a while until we have a final judgment in the case. But nevertheless, that was a great victory. Another one are cases that settled out of court, that we are able to get the defendant, either a terror organization or a bank that supported this organization, to understand that it's not worth their while to continue the case until the end and to settle it out of court. Shredin was also involved with a non-terror leading a terror victims litigation cases, like stopping the Gaza flotilla, and other human rights cases that we were involved with, which also became a victory in the end of the day.
In the end of the book, you talk about the social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. Tell us about how they play into the terror network and what's likely to come next.
Well, it's not a secret that terrorism changes form. And today there are individuals that go and carry terror attacks, stabbing attacks in Israel in the past year and a half, and car rabbing attacks in Israel, in Europe, in the United States. And the way, the reason for these terrorists to go and terror attacks is because of the incitement, is because the encouragement that they receive from the social media, posts that calling them to go and kill innocent civilians. So in the beginning, the Israeli government and the and officials of the American government approached the social media networks and asked them to turn down this incitement. But the social media giants refused. Facebook, Twitter, Google, they said they're only a platform, they're only a bulletin board, they're not getting involved in their, with the users, with the content on the platform, they're not taking a side in any of this conflict. So we initially decided to sue Facebook as the first case. We filed a lawsuit in the federal court in New York for injunction to have Facebook turn down all this incitement, but also for monetary damages, because unfortunately, the social media networks are protected by American law, a U.S. law called the Communication Decency Act. This is a law from 1996 that grants blanket immunity to social media networks from the content that users are posting on their platform. Complete immunity. So we understand that there is a problem. However, there is not immunity from aiding and abetting terrorism, meaning American company is not allowed to provide a designated terror organization with material support, with any sort of services. And this is exactly what the social media companies are doing. Facebook or Twitter or Google are providing designated terror organizations like Hamas, like ISIS, to recruit militants. They're spending their propaganda, their ideology, their ideas, and convincing people to join them, to become combatants, to become terrorists. They raise funds on the social media network. They are using the social media network as an essential tool in their operation, something they never had before and cannot do without. And doing this is a prohibition of the Anti-Terrorism Act of the United States, which imposed civil and criminal liability on the social media networks. So another case we filed was a monetary lawsuit against Facebook for providing this platform to Hamas, to ISIS. The cases were filed also against Twitter, against Google, on behalf of ISIS victims. And the cases are litigated now in the federal courts in the United States, in New York, in California.
I want to thank Nitzana Darshan-Leitner for a great visit here on Two Jewish. There's so much more we could cover. The book is called Harpoon Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. It reads like a spy thriller, except it's all true. Where can people go to find out more about Shurat HaDin and the work that you do?
They can go on the website, IsraelLawCenter.org. They can go on our Facebook. And I urge them all to join us. It's the time for the private sector to fight back.
Thank you so much, Nitzana, and keep doing this great work. It's extremely important, and you've invented really a whole new specialty and a really important one. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be one of our very favorites, Dara Horn, the multi-award-winning author of the brand new book, Eternal Life. Don't miss her. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our twojewishradio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from Yonatan Rezel, the Shabbat Smira, the table song, Dror Yikra. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
ואין צורכם כמו ואהבת נעים שמכם ולא יושבת שבו בנוחו ביום שבת לראש נביא ואולמי ואות ישע עשה עימי לטס הורק בתוך קרמי ששבת בני עמי דרור יקרא לבן אמבט ואין צורכם נעים שמכם ולא יושבת שבורכו ביום שבת לרור יקרא לבן אמבט ואין צורכם כמו ואהבת נעים שמכם ולא יושבת שבורכו ביום שבת דרוך פורה בתוך בוצרה וגם בבל אשר גברה נטוץ צרי באברה שמה קולי ביום נקר אלוקים תן במדבר הר הדס שיטה בראש תדהר ולמזהיר ולנזהר שלא ממתן כמי נהר דרור יקרא לבן אמבט ואין צרכם כמו ואהבת נעים שמכם ולא יושבת שבורכו ביום שבת לרור יקרא לבן אמבט ואין צרכם כמו ואהבת נעים שמכם ולא יושבת שבורכו ביום שבת נה 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 שבונו חובי יום שבת.